against native people is still going on today, all over the world.
Native Solidarity News. It's about you, too. CKUT, CKDU, CFBEX, CFUV, CHFN, CHLY, CHMA, CHSR, CJLY, CJSF, CJSW, Radio 90.
All right, welcome to NSN, Native Solidarity News, here on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm here with Dan and JJ, and my name is Urquhart. Here we're going to bring you some, we're going to bring you some features, some news, everything from our Nation of the Red. We're going to play some, music. We've got a little classic one here. This is Starwalker from Buffy St. Marie. Back here, we got Dan with the news, and yeah, how you doing, Dan?
Good, Urquhart. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. I had a fantastic weekend.
Nice. So later on in the show, we're going to be hearing an interview, edited by JJ, with Taika Alfred about decolonization and building an indigenous North American movement for autonomy and self-determination, and that'll be coming up in the second half of the show. But first, we've got an announcement, and then we've got a little, we've got some stuff having to do with Invasion Day or Columbus Day. But so the first announcement is that if you're in the Montreal area, next Monday, October 17th, there will be a book launch of Something New in the Air, the story of First Peoples television broadcasting in Canada. So this will be a book about the APTN, I assume. And so this is going to be happening at Concordia University at 2149 McKay. It starts at 5:45, and there's going to be free food and drinks. This is a book launch that'll be happening on next Monday. And so now, Urquhart and I are going to do something a little special. This was written by Tom Purcell for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and it's a conversation between a father and son.
Dad, why does America celebrate Columbus Day?
Well, Billy, in 1492, Christopher Columbus sailed from Europe to America and founded the very first settlement in the New World. His arrival marks the beginning of America as we know it.
But didn't he discover America by accident, Dad?
Columbus believed the Earth was a sphere. He thought he could reach the Far East by setting off on a westward course. Though he stumbled upon what is now the Bahamas by accident, he was still a great explorer and a great man, Billy.
A great man, Dad, or a racist oppressor?
Pardon me, son?
When Columbus came to America, he brought with him the great greed of the white European males who subsequently colonized America for the dough. They fought and they killed the indigenous people who were already here and took their land and their gold. Columbus was eventually died a very rich man.
Well, Billy, an unfortunate part of human history involves countries invading their neighbors to take control. This has happened in many parts of the world, including Europe, which has a long history of war. But remember that indigenous peoples were also prone to war and fighting to expand their control well before Europeans arrived.
Well, Columbus is also responsible for very many germs and diseases that Europeans brought to America, causing untold suffering and death among the people who were here before us.
Have you been drinking too much caffeine lately, Billy?
America's history of environmental destruction can also be laid at Columbus's feet, Dad. As soon as the Europeans colonized America's pristine lands, they cut down the trees and they plowed up the fields. Can you say soil erosion, Dad?
Son, did I ever tell you that you take after your mother's side?
And what about slavery? It was Europeans who created a flourishing slave trade in America. They did it to develop the land cheaply so they could make giant profits. Columbus even made slaves out of some of the indigenous people who attacked him and his men.
Son, do you remember where your mother hid the bourbon?
I'll tell you another thing, Dad. The only reason we even celebrate Columbus Day is because he was Italian. And that day is also a celebration of Italian heritage. When FDR made Columbus Day official in 1934, he did it not just because Columbus discovered the New World, but because the Italian immigrants in America represented millions of votes.
Look, Billy, there are lots of ways to look at what Christopher Columbus symbolizes. You can focus on the negative attributes, and there are some. Or you can do what America has been doing for many years now. Focus on the positive.
Positive, Dad?
Sure, Billy. Columbus represents the spirit of exploration, the spirit of pushing forward into the great unknown to find greater and better things. This has always been the spirit of America, the land of innovation and new ideas.
What kind of ideas, Dad?
What about the ideas of freedom and self-government, Billy? After Columbus opened a gateway to the New World, other European countries established colonies here, too. Eventually, some amazing historical figures would evolve in North America. They would create and fight for a way of life that has proved to be extremely successful. Their ideas are still spreading and changing the world for the better.
Really, Dad?
Yes, son. The concept of freedom has taken root so solidly in America that people are free to criticize or praise anything, including whether or not Christopher Columbus was a hero or an ogre, or whether or not Columbus Day should still be celebrated in America. Now, do you have any other questions about history?
Sure, Dad. Was Benjamin Franklin really a predatory male chauvinist womanizer?
And that, once again, comes from the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Yes. Don't expect radio plays every week, only on specially racist holidays. But in the theme of Invasion Day, we have some more positive news from Venezuela. This comes from the Green Left Weekly. On October 12th, most countries in Latin America celebrated Día de la Raza, or Day of the Races, which in 1492 marked the beginning of the Spanish Empire's destruction of millions of years of the continent's indigenous history in just a few decades. Yet in Venezuela, the day is now commemorated as the Day of Indigenous Resistance. And to participate in public discussion about the impact of colonialism on indigenous communities and what can be done to redress this. According to the National Census, Venezuela has about 500,000 indigenous people, many living in 2,300 distinct autonomous communities. While there have been many gains made over the past 6 years, perhaps the most significant occurred on August 9th of this year, when, on ancestral lands in Santa Rosa de Tacata, Chavez, President Chavez, issued formal land titles over traditional lands to representatives of the Karina peoples. Noheli Pocatera, indigenous activist and member of the Presidential Commission, said at the ceremony, "Simon Bolivar, the first liberator, gave back the lands, the best lands, to the original inhabitants. But President Chavez is the first president to ever do this to dispossessed indigenous peoples." According to Pocatera, recognition of ancestral lands was a precondition for advancing the missions with indigenous communities. "For the first time in Venezuela," he continues, "there is justice for our people. These lands have a great magic and spiritual feeling for our indigenous peoples, and is life for us." Venezuela's Bolivarian Constitution devotes its entire eighth chapter to indigenous rights, outlining land rights and the state's obligation to promote indigenous cultural values and to consult with communities regarding activities such as mining and development. There is a guaranteed presence of three indigenous members in the National Assembly and one state governor. There are also indigenous deputies in the state parliaments and in the ministries, such as the National Youth Institute. The Bolivarian state also recognizes traditional medicine and complementary treatments and protects collective property, knowledge, and technology. And this, again, comes from the Green Left Weekly. And so we're going to wrap up this news segment with one more piece from Venezuela, this time from Cultural Survival. On October 28th, Venezuela will distribute 28 different indigenous language textbooks to indigenous schools throughout the country. La Agencia Bolivariana de Noticias, the ABN, reported the Ministry of Indigenous Education as saying, "We hope to bring these books to all the natives who live dispersed throughout national territory. For this reason, the books will be sent to all the regions where we have detected indigenous groups." End quote. The books that will be available to indigenous youth include dictionaries, grammar textbooks, beginning reading textbooks, and other basic education books. According to ABN, Pocatera emphasized that the Ministry of Indigenous Education has created schools which respect the use of indigenous languages, traditions, customs, and values. So it looks like things are pretty all right in Venezuela. Hopefully we can do some interviews there soon and hear straight from people in the communities how they react to these policies and what they think of Chavez. So that does it for these new segments. We're just going to take a quick music break, and we'll be right back with more Native Solidarity news.
All right, yeah, this one's an oldie but a goodie. This land.
believe. Someday the sun will shine, you shall be free. When blessed children as they're put to the test, you'll be
that was Glass Tiger, Native Son. That's from their Thin Red Line album. Right now, we're going to be going right to our feature, but JJ is going to introduce that for us.
Yes, thank you, Urkar. So our feature this week is has been edited down from audio that was provided to us from an ongoing work focusing on natives in Canada and Palestine. So if you like what you hear, you can get more information and information on how to support this educational documentary at 514-398-6788. We'll repeat that number again at the end of the feature if you're interested in finding out more about it. It's an interview with Tayayage Alfred. He is a Gunyungahage, a philosopher, writer, and teacher. He is currently the Indigenous Peoples Research Chair at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. He was born in Montreal and raised in the community of Ganawage, and has written two books, Peace, Power, Righteousness, An Indigenous Manifesto, published by Oxford University Press in 1999, and also Heeding the Voices of Our Ancestors, Ganawage Mohawk Politics and the Rise of Native Nationalism, also Oxford University Press, 1999. So he is talking about decolonization and an Indigenous movement to regain self-determination. So, without further ado, we will start that feature.
One thing that we wanted to ask, how do you see the band council system fitting in the colonial project? How does a colonial power use such a thing, an election process or something like this, to weaken a community?
Well, it's actually difficult at this point to talk about the band council as distinct from the community, because it's been in place so long and it has such a presence in the community, legally, economically, politically, that I think in previous generations you could kind of separate the two and say, you know, there's the community, there's the traditions and so forth, and then there's the band council, which is an obvious imposition. But over the last three or four generations, our people have become so closely intertwined with that colonial system that it's difficult to see one for the other. And so in theoretical terms, we can talk about it in that way. But in reality, you know, what you find is that even when you call yourself a traditionalist or you try to decolonize your own mind and operate according to a different worldview and value system, you find yourself still attached to that band council system and operating within it. in a certain way in different aspects of your life, just in the more mundane aspects of provision of services and so forth. You know, you can't get away from that fact. I mean, if you own a house, you need water and sewer and all that kind of stuff, and that the band council provides that sorts of thing. If you want to go to school, it's the institution that facilitates the funding for that sort of thing. So it's real difficult to talk about it as in strict separate terms. I mean, I guess that's the answer to the question, is that they've constructed a reality that is totally colonial in its premises in terms of the way that our world operates. That it's almost impossible to just be an indigenous person in the conception of our ancestors. You know, so the band council system is part, it's symbol of, it's instrumental to, and it is in fact the framework as well. It's sort of emblematic of our own colonization, and it's emblematic of it because we're critical of it, and we're conscious of the fact that it's not our system. Although many of our people have embraced it, it's not authentic, but it's also indispensable to our current existence in a lot of ways. So colonialism is that, I believe. It's the construction of a reality, at first in obvious imposition terms, but over time it gets legitimized and it gets normalized. It's where the reality itself is confusing. And so for our people who call themselves traditionalists, I think what that is really just a tag word for people that have woken up to the fact of their own inauthentic existence and have made, to varying degrees, efforts to recover their authenticity in ceremony, language, longhouse participation in ceremonies, and so forth, are ways that people can go about doing that. My own ideas is that we need to go a lot further. You know, it's not only the ceremonies and the language and the political aspects of it, but how we think, how we behave, how we feed ourselves, our relationship to the land, environmental ethic. All those things have kind of taken a backseat to a more political definition of decolonization. So my own work, my own ideas these days are oriented around a more comprehensive view.
You just mentioned that over time there's this whole reality being created, and after time it becomes legitimized. Now, maybe we can you can explain to us how this legitimization happens, you know, whether it's by looking at how the pressure is put on or the coverage is made of through public you know, medias or so on.
Well, in a sense, it's real simple. I mean, the details in Canada are immense. I mean, you could talk all day about specific cases if you want to talk about details, dates, and I think there's a very simple framework to colonization. The power creates the conditions of dependency. They create desperation. And they offer an institutional solution to that, or at least an institution which moderates some of the suffering that they've generated. And they call that government. And in this case, that was the case with dispossession of lands, laws restricting movement and education, racism, and so forth, which created conditions of dependency in the native community. And then they offered an institution to which funneled some monetary relief into that situation. It really got consolidated in Ganawage in the Depression, the last Great Depression in the 1930s. From our oral history, the band council really developed as an institution through the relief efforts that were provided to the community, to the extent they were provided during that period. So previous to this, you know, there was the option to legitimize or not legitimize the band council, and some people vehemently opposed to it and sticking to our own form of government. But with the collapse of the economy and the desperate economic situation, the government offered aid through the band council system. And from that point on, you know, the development of that institution was always done in the context of that dependency which continued to exist, because when the Depression was over, our people recovered somewhat economically. But of course, as you develop a community in the condition of colonization, there's no self-sufficiency. There's no opportunity to generate revenue, to provide services and so forth. It's all done through the colonial system, and this Bank Council was the institution that facilitated that and affected it. And so, in simple terms, it's a generation of dependency and manipulating that situation of dependency in order to take advantage of people's need for basic services and basic elements of survival. And then post facto call that legitimation.
We saw also in our visits in many different nations, not only the Mohawk Nation, how divisions happen between the community over those resources that are being offered in the jobs. How does that play in creating such a structure? How does that play into the colonial process?
Well, it's a fundamental question in every community. Some people are more pragmatic, and some people are more principled. I mean, you can look India, Palestine, South Africa, everywhere, and it's always that basic tension. And I think the strength of the culture and the coherence of the community will lead to a situation where you have more people standing on principle. Where the culture and the community are weakened, you'll have more people thinking in individualistic terms about their own pragmatic survival or that of their family. And so that's why the cultural agenda of the state has always been at the forefront when it comes to indigenous people, because they realize the culture is the bond which resistance survives on. If you can break the culture by, for example, breaking the language and deculturating the youth by taking away their history and so forth, you basically have a bunch of individuals grouped together living on something called a reserve. It's very easy to manipulate them based on their individual wants and needs. They don't have a cultural referent. They don't have a coherent sense of community. Now, it's not that extreme in the case of Ganawage or Aguzasne, or for that matter, most Native communities. There's culture, there's traditional beliefs and so forth, but nowhere near the kind of solidarity and the kind of rootedness that our ancestors had even 2-3 generations ago. So residential school and language loss, I think, are probably the two most important factors that created that environment for individualism to emerge. And to me, that's what it is. It's a human choice between pragmatics and principles. And in any revolutionary situation, you have people that, against human nature, choose principle. And unfortunately, in our case now, most people are choosing pragmatics, because our leaders have focused on materialism as opposed to cultural revitalization.
Ah! See on the horizon with the space that your own program, your program of study here at the University of Victoria, what kind of change might that be bringing to the colonial process in Canada, which seemingly from the nations that we visited is still in full effect?
Yeah, I think that the first change that we're observing in terms of what you've said is in regard to the fact that within the Native movement, so to speak, itself, it's no longer identified with one particular community or nation, this kind of nationalistic, or I'd say just what it is, indigenous worldview and indigenous set of commitments. In fact, the Mohawks today are not very Mohawk, if you want to think about it. You know, the band councils in Akwesaste and Ganawage, Six Nations, are pretty moving pretty much towards an assimilationist program and agenda. Our communities are, you know, very much committed to economic development in legal and illegal ways, and to a certain extent, you know, the classic by now 1970s and 80s Mohawk nationalism is evaporating, and it's changing, but that sensibility, that worldview, and those sets of commitments have been dispersed to other nations. So that's my answer to your question about what I'm up to. You know, you're trying to take that sense of being indigenous in a very contentious, very rooted way, very radical way, in a lot of people's perspective, and connect with other native people who are drawn to that as well, and to try to build a movement out of it. So it's to take that sense that I grew up with in the community about what it was to be Mohawk, and even as it's failing in our own communities, to go and to try to generate a movement that's, for lack of a better word, pan-Indigenous, so that we have a much broader threat to the state, not in physical terms, because we found that that's basically untenable. Physically confronting the state today with the level of authority that they've been given and the level of physical force that they have, it's a frustrating enterprise. But to confront it in political and cultural and social terms on this broad front, as opposed to just one community or one nation standing up and representing what it is to be an Indigenous resistor, I think is the first change that we've seen and that we are seeing. I think that in the long term it has a potential to provide an alternative way of thinking and way of being Indigenous when the assimilative models inevitably fail. The joke, I guess, on those people who believe in assimilation is that you can't they try to assimilate, but they can't. It's undermined either by mainstream society's continuing commitment to white supremacy, or by their own spiritual defeat and feeling like a sellout or a traitor for having done it, and then they sabotage themselves by their own behaviors, alienation, and then all the medications that you need to ingest to do that, to deal with that. And our people are going to need something to fall back on if our people are going to survive as communities. And what I'm trying to do is to keep alive that sense of what it is to be Ungwehunwe in a true sense, not imagining that people are going to be all of a sudden converted, and that people are going to give up their jobs in the government or in a corporation or some or whatever to become radical. But when that path fails, or when the government does turn their back on natives again, that there is something there for people to look to as a framework for being indigenous and for orienting their action to again restore our nationhood. So it's kind of a long-term vision, but it's something that you have to invest a lot of time in, because essentially what you have to do is you have to generate leaders. You know, you have to create leaders in a cultural, political, social, and legal sense to be able to carry this vision, and then to go and do what they do, and to slowly work their way into our people's minds and get people thinking in a different way. And I think in crisis situations, the opportunity is there to really advance the agenda. But the government seems very good at managing crisis these days, and it's going to be much more of a longer process. But I think on an individual terms, people inevitably get dissatisfied with the path of assimilation, and they begin to look for something more real. So we're here to keep it real.
The work of this pan-Indigenous movement, do you see it as putting Canada in the spotlight to say what it's done has been wrong in terms of its cultural policies, its assimilation policies, of its ongoing colonial project? Is it going to frame the discussion in such a way that there are rights and wrongs, and that there are lessons learned, rather than, say, a farce of multiculturalism?
I think that's a that's a foundational perspective. It's something that we've been talking about for a while. I think the average Canadian, yeah, does need to be exposed to that view. But I also think, on the other hand, that any Canadian of any kind of power or influence already knows that and has reconciled herself or himself to that. So it's kind of moving beyond that to say, let's force them to respond. So the phrase that we start using was, we want to be a credible threat. Not in violent terms, not in terms of terrorism, but in terms of threatening people's security with themselves and who they are. And the standard status quo pattern of existence needs to change. And the only way that's going to change is if it's disrupted. So you have phrases like guerrilla education and cultural resistance and so forth, and straight out, once there's a solid enough base for this, political contention. You know, Gandhi didn't use violence, but he pretty much disrupted the operation of British imperial rule in that country. It's vastly different situations here, but the idea is the same. If we're going to be effective in challenging colonialism, the first step is opening up people's minds, as you're talking, but the real definition of a decolonizing movement is when you do something about it. And so we have to figure out what's an effective course of action. So I'm always trying to focus these days on action, and looking at patterns of action that would disrupt the pattern of colonialism, so that there's this space now, there's an instance or a space when you can define a new way, and realizing that there's going to be like a whole multiplicity of instances when this is going to happen. It's not going to be like one watershed event. I mean, we read history, and we think that civil rights movement happened like this, and all of a sudden people think, but you know, like years and years and years and years of smaller victories that kind of built up into something. And I think that when Canadians come to the conclusion that their society is unjust, on one hand, that's kind of like the moral question, but then there's also the economic and political imperative of, well, if we want to preserve our country, we better change. And when those two conclusions come together, then we'll have some. But right now we have neither. You know, for the most part, there's people like you and me and people listening to your show who are like, yeah, Canada's a colonial country and it's wrong, but the average person, they think Canada's great. So the first thing is to defeat that myth, and then to cause them to want to act on it, that's like the next level. So I'm trying to prepare people who are capable and willing to do both of those.
In terms of all of the people that we've been interviewing around the question, around the country, one question that I keep coming back to is particularly geared towards young people who are finding their place in colonial Canada today. What sorts of message of hope would you give them towards changing the direction of this colonial project?
Well, I think it's hopeful and motivating to think that they can be part of a movement that decolonizes their country finally. You know, I think the most depressing thing is to realize that you've inherited materially wealthy, middle of the road, satisfactory colonial society where you can, as an individual, work and get a house and have a good standard of living. It's depressing to think that that's all there is to being Canadian, and to be part of a struggle to make something better out of the legacy they've been handed, to actually make a just country. That would motivate me, and I think younger people are motivated by that sort of thing when they're brought to realization that there's a disjuncture between their idea of what their country is and what it really is. I think they want to reconcile that. That's pretty motivating, you know, for most young people. Trick is to get them to stay motivated beyond that period of youthful energy and to have them not sucked into the patterns of consumption and so forth that lead to very conservative attitudes. So that's why I think economic and political action are important, to disrupt those patterns.
I guess I'm going to ask one last question. When we went up to the north and visited Dene territory, I noticed that from the numbers that they are in the majority, still in their own home, you know. So it kind of scared me that even though they were majority in their own home, they were not able to take control of their territory. So how deep is this multi-generational trauma, you know, that is affected, you know, the communities there, that they're not able to do it there?
Well, yeah, I think you've answered your own question. It is this trauma that leads to fear. Fear of themselves, lack of confidence in their own abilities, defeatism, for lack of a better word, and undue and bizarre adulation of white society. You know, they've been taught that way through residential school and media and so forth, builds up this image of white society, and then they turn around and they look at themselves and there's really no comparison in their minds. I think that kind of defeatism on a kind of political and a cultural and a psychic, spiritual level is what's responsible for the situation where in places like Saskatchewan and Regina, where you have areas that are 70% Native and so forth, there's no organization, no power to take control. Certainly up north and in Nunavut, where it's 80% of the population, but yet they're going forward with the white way and the rules, and very unchallenging, very cooperative with colonialism. There's that which is the underlying feature, I think, and a very, very important feature too, and always has been from the time of first contact, is that there are very influential and powerful indigenous collaborators with white supremacy. And those people who tend to be educated and powerful are almost uniformly collaborative with, on a personal level, on a political level, social level, the continuing assertion of white power. So, I mean, defeatist attitudes, collaborators, and active efforts on the part of the state to maintain control add up to the situation that we find, not only in Dene De, or Northwest Territories, or Nunavut, but lots of other places in the world. So, I mean, there's some hope in that, in the sense that if it is such a pattern, you would think that there would be people writing and speaking about this, so that it would be something that we could expose, but you've traveled around lots, and I think that you find very few people willing to threaten their own comfort as writers, as artists, as academics, in bringing these messages forward, and beyond that, acting on them to change things. But yeah, it's a psychic colonization of the mind, right? Until that's defeated, until that's overcome, there's really no sense in trying to negotiate a political change at all. So we got to work on freeing their mind, and then their asses will follow after that, right? It's been said before.
You went into the depths of the university system. How did you prevent your own self from becoming any sort of collaborator? Or did nobody extend it?
Oh, no, I was offered lots. I guess I collaborated a certain bit when I was less secure about the limits, where you could see. I have a pretty definite idea now. Although it's never entirely clear, I think I have a pretty good sense of how far you can go before you're actually serving their agenda and not yours. You know, there's always a space in between where you're taking advantage of an opportunity, and people can debate, you know, whose side you're on. But, you know, at the time when I was younger, you have to learn those limits by doing it. And you're right in saying that, you know, the question is, how do you maintain a rootedness? Well, I guess I'm lucky I'm from Ganawage, where people hold you accountable for what you say and what you do, right? So being part of a family and a community, on one hand, that does that, but on the other hand, I'll take credit for having the commitment to that. You could run away from it. You could just not go home, right? But I was always very open in what I was doing. No matter what I was thinking or writing or saying or doing, I never tried to hide anything. I was just right out there. And so you learn over time the limits. Like, I always had the commitment to working for the people. And I always hated colonialism and wanted to build up our nation. And if at one time I thought what I was doing was the way, and now I think it was wrong, well, I learned that by doing it. And then finding out that, yeah, it's working against this agenda that I have. So then I have to change, and that's the key there, is like being able to admit you're wrong and having the ability, in terms of your own skills and self-sufficiency, to jump away from that and go down a better path. Not everybody should be put forward into that position, because some people are too easily sucked in. They don't have enough cultural background, they're too selfish, they don't have enough family or community support. You don't have the right kind of training. So you don't want just anybody getting in there in the depths of education or government. It has to be someone that you know is going to turn around when it's wrong. And again, that's the kind of people we're trying to create here. You know, we don't tell them. Well, actually, I do tell them. You can't go work for Indian Affairs, but you know, you could go work for any other institution you want out there. Just know that when it gets going in the wrong direction and you find yourself working against your people, then turn around and go somewhere else. That's as much as we could say, I think, to anybody. So for myself, that's what I learned. And it's absolutely essential to maintain that connection to community for that reason. Physically, socially, culturally, and accountability in terms of answering to them. Straight out, who do you answer to? If you continue to say I answer to the elders and the people in the community, then it's good. If you begin to answer to your boss instead of them, then you're lost. Your for all intents and purposes turned into an instrument of colonialism as opposed to an agent opposed to colonialism.
And we're back.
That was, once again, that was an interview that you heard with Tayayage Alfred. He is a Gunyungahage from Ganawage, and he is the Indigenous Peoples Research Chair at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. If you want to hear, or if you want to get more information from him, he has two books. One is called Peace, Power, Righteousness, an Indigenous Manifesto. The other is Heeding the Voices of Our Ancestors, Ganawage Mohawk Politics and the Rise of Native Nationalism. Both are Oxford University Press, published in 1999. He also has a website, www.wasase.org. That's www.wasase.org. And there's a lot of interesting stuff on there. He also has a whole bunch of speaking dates. For those of you in the Montreal area, October 22nd, he will be coming to Ganawage, the cultural center there. And he's also going to be in Manitoba, Ontario, and New York in October. And that audio is, we have to give plenty thanks to Laith and Gretchen, who conducted that interview for their ongoing work, which is focusing on natives in Canada and Palestine. So for more information on how to support that educational documentary, you can call 514-398-6788. That's 514-398-6788. So a big thank you to Laith and Gretchen for putting in that time, and also to Tayayage Alfred for his work and his time, too. And I think coming up next, we have some news stories from Dan.
That's right, JJ. We just have a couple more short pieces to round out the hour. This first one comes from the National Indigenous Times from Occupied Australia. Figures from the New South Wales Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research show that Aboriginal women are four times more likely than other women in New South Wales to be victim of assault, murder, and domestic violence. The statistics prompted Ms. Pam Greer, advocate on the topic of violence in Aboriginal communities, to address the issue at a major conference on violence against women last month. "The issue of violence and Aboriginal women must be included in every conversation at every level," says Ms. Greer. "Aboriginal women continue to be vulnerable in their communities, in their homes, and within the systems which should be protecting them." Ms. Greer also said that there are many myths and conceptions associated with this issue, and that if judges and police and society continue to believe these myths, then we'll be waiting a very long time to see change. This issue, along with many others concerning violence against women, were addressed at the three-day conference, Refocusing Women's Experiences of Violence. Conference organizer Betty Green said, "Violence against women is a serious social issue, and we as a community need to talk about it and look at ways to work towards changing the attitudes and beliefs that support violence against women." The final piece for today comes from ALC. An armed group of more than 150 people stormed into the indigenous area of Raposa Serra do Sol on September 17th, setting ablaze the Surumu Mission Culture and Training Center, located roughly 230 kilometers from Boa Vista, the Roraima state capital in northern Brazil. The fire destroyed the church, hospital, bedrooms, bathrooms, library, hall, and faculty housing there. According to the Indigenous Mission Council, the CIMI, an agency of the Catholic Church, the attack was clearly intended to intimidate the indigenous Makuksi, Injaroko, Oropang, Wapishna, and Pantamama communities, which were preparing to celebrate the Indigenous Land Demarcation Agreement signed last April by President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. The CIMI held responsible municipal employees connected with the mayor of Paracaramea, the region's principal rice producer. In January 2004, the Surumu Mission was attacked by the same group, and three priests were kidnapped and held hostage for 3 days. Unfortunately, reported CIMI, The delay of justice to punish those responsible encourages the continuance of these acts of violence and vandalism. For more information about the CIMI, an organization that supports the struggle of indigenous peoples in Brazil, a struggle mainly concentrated on land issues because land is central for the well-being and survival of Brazil's indigenous population, you can visit their website at www.cimi.org.br. Or for a more indigenous, less Catholic perspective, you can visit the website of the Indigenous Council of Roraima, the CIR, at www.cir.org.br.
All right, now that was Dan. Thanks, Dan. And JJ, this is Native Solidarity News. We are now signing off. Soul Perspectives is coming up next, so stay tuned. This is CKUT 90.3.